So because Mumble takes 4 years to create new versions, we're just going to refer to Mumble 1.3 as New Mumble for the next 4 years, right?
Right.
Goes.
Just like they did with XFCE.
Uh-huh.
Why wouldn't you?
Now and forever, it is New Mumble. Welcome to Mintcast episode 319. Livestream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel in IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, tell us. Send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Join us on MeWe, Facebook, the Mintcast subreddit, Telegram, Discord, or post directly at mintcast.org. This is Leo, and with me today is Joe.
Hello, hello.
Tony Hughes.
Hi, guys.
Josh.
Hello.
And we re-welcome Moss.
I'm not dead yet.
And this week, we're recording on Sunday, October 6th, 2019. First up in our wanderings, I talk dynamic DNS. Tony's writing articles, Moss test drives Endeavor OS, Josh visited Media City, and Joe relaxes with fiction. Then, our news. CentOS 8 and Mumble 1.3 are released. Ubuntu 19.10 is almost here. The GNOME Foundation and Docker navigate rough seas, and more. So this week, in Wanderings, I feel like I've been really, really busy, but then when I wrote it down, it didn't seem like so much. So I kind of feel like I'm forgetting something. So if I, in the middle of the show, start talking about something totally different, that's probably what happened. So dynamic DNS. This took me a while to get on board with doing dynamic DNS, but in Telegram, we had, I think it was a conversation between Peter Jones, Oliver Kelly, and Crypto Dan, and everybody was talking about dynamic DNS, how awesome it is, and especially for if your IP address at your home internet connection changes a lot, and you have things that are hosted at your house. Like for me, I have OpenVPN running, and it's kind of a pain if I run into a situation where I'm away from home and then my ISP decided we're rebooting everything and then I get a new IP address, none of my stuff works. So, and it's not really that easy to fix either. What I ended up having to do anytime they changed my IP address was I run PyVPN. I'd have to log into its interface and just delete or revoke the certificate that I had, go into a configuration file, update the IP address, remint the certificate, and then push that back out to my devices. So that was a pain. So now the whole reason why I've finally come over to the dynamic side is now I don't have to do that. And it really kind of got sore, I guess, because my ISP recently, either they reboot their stuff more often now or they just don't give me the same IP address when they do that kind of thing. So it's just kind of every couple of weeks, it seems like, I have a new IP, and I don't want to have to fix that every couple of weeks. So I thought I got this figured out in my router. I have a EdgeRouter PoE 5, and I think I got it set up. I don't know yet because my IP address hasn't changed, and I did this about a week ago, last weekend. And every time I do a test, it says no connection. But when you do it manually, when you, I did afraid.org, and the way that they do this is you basically just click on a link and it'll update your IP address. Wherever you're coming from, that will automatically update what afraid.org has for you. So the name works, essentially. And so when I click that, it actually gives me an error and says there's nothing to update. So I'm thinking maybe my router does work, but since it didn't get a thumbs up, it's just saying no connection. But I'm not holding my breath. So, in the spirit of what we're going to talk about in the innards that get released next week, I figured out how to do a cron job to make this work. So, I also run Pi-hole to kill ads in my internal network. And so, on that machine, I created a cron job that basically just goes to that URL using curl. And I do that every 6 hours, and it'll update my IP address. So, worst case scenario, my VPN will be broken for 5 hours and change. But that's worst case scenario. And it turns out that I really like afraid.org. They do this, you get to pick from like a crazy long list of domains. I chose moo.com. So it's my chosen name, .moo.com is where I live now. And yeah, to avoid DDoSes and all that kind of stuff, I won't say that on the show. But either way, it's actually really, really simple. And they give you 5 different domains that you can do for free, all for free. It all sets up for free. They're all independent of each other. It's really, really interesting and nice to get set up. So anyway, it's really nice to be able to not have to worry about if my IP address changed and now my OpenVPN is broken. So
why every 6 hours?
Oh, okay. Actually, I do have a really good answer for that. So when you're going through it on afraid.org and they're telling you how to set this up, they say, set it up in your router. But if you don't do it in your router, do it through a script. And they kind of give you an idea of how to write that script. So it's really, really easy. But they have it in the script where it happens every 5 minutes. And then they go on to say, hey, like increment that 5 minutes by 1 or 2. So it's not happening on the 0 minute, on the 5 minute, on the 10 minute. So what they want you to do is do it at like 6:01 and then 6:06 and then 6:11, something like that, right? So I'm like, all right, these guys are doing me a solid in the first place by giving this stuff for me for free. So I'm just going to be really nice and only ask to update 4 times a day. So it was more of an arbitrary choice, and I just figured 4 times a day was probably enough. And that was that ended up being kind of a challenge in cron because there's no easy shortcut to make that happen. So you have to like do commas. So it gets kind of crazy, but yeah, no real reason other than I'm trying to be nice to the guys that are giving me stuff for free. So then I've got a couple of things that I installed here in the past couple of weeks. It is tp-smapi.dkms and acpi-call-dkms. So on a ThinkPad, you want to install, It's the name of that thing that that gives you better battery life. Oh man, now I have to go look. Hang on one sec, because I'll find the name of it. Oh, TLP. So it's a thing that helps you get better battery life and sets different settings so that your laptop behaves while it's on battery. Well, it turns out that these additional packages are supposed to help the kernel speak to the firmware in the laptop to better calibrate your batteries, which in turn should help you get better battery life. Now, I've only done a full cycle, a full discharge cycle, and I'm actually currently charging from that right now. I'm not at 100% yet. So I'm gonna find out soon enough if that makes things better or worse. But as of right now, it didn't blow anything up, so I'm at least happy about that. So good stuff either way. And if you haven't installed TLP on your laptop, it might be worth checking it out. It's pretty much just as easy as sudo apt install TLP, and that'll take care of the bulk of it for you. If you're running a Lenovo or, I guess, mainstream laptop Dell, there might be some additional things that you might want to do for your laptop. But TLP is fantastic. It did help me squeeze an extra hour out of my batteries right off the get. So I'm hoping I get an extra 15, 30 minutes out of these additional packages. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. But enough about me. Tony, what have you been up to?
Okay. Decided I was, after seeing a call for new writers for Full Circle magazine, I decided to start to write a series of articles on getting started in podcasting. I pitched it to Ronnie at Full Circle Mag, and he came back and said, oh yeah, great. So I've actually written the first 2 articles and sent them off. So you may, if you're lucky, get to see me in print in October, because I sent it in before the deadline for the October magazine, which comes out at the end of the month.
Yeah, and that should be 150? Is that the issue that you're going to be in?
Hopefully. Obviously, it depends if there's space for this month's magazine, but I would have thought so, because Ronnie's been struggling with articles, he said. He's got a couple of long-running series coming to an end.
Cool. I'll keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm also still running MX-19 Beta 2.1, although Beta 3 was released yesterday. I've downloaded the ISO and I'm thinking about installing. I might just install it in a virtual machine because I'm not at home at the moment. I'm away again for a week. So I might just stick it in a virtual machine and have a play around with that while I keep the Beta 2.1 installed on the Toshiba. But yeah, so if anyone's thinking of having a play with MX, go and grab the 19 Beta 3 if you want to have a play with it. So far, I'm quite impressed. I found one little minor bug, which I've actually got a reply to say that they looked into it and they recognise it is a bug. Basically, what was happening, if you're not in the systemd boot up, when you drop to restart the machine, I imagine it probably does the same when you go to shut down, but it's for some reason it drops into the login screen and hangs in there for about between 5 and 10 seconds before it starts the shutdown process. And if you've done the reboot process, it doesn't seem to affect it if you've booted in using systemd. So obviously they don't want it to do that. It's something to do with the Windows Manager. So I got a response from Dolphin, one of the maintainers, and he said, yes, they've looked at it. They know it's something to do with the Windows Manager, but at the moment they can't find a fix for it. So they've put it on the to-do list because they want to fix it, but they're not sure how. So, yeah, I was quite pleased to have got a response to that. And it's the first time I've ever done a bug report. So it's great to see that they look at them and test them out and see what they can do about them.
That's a really good feeling, knowing that you're helping out.
Yeah. So that's about it for me. Moss, what have you been up to?
Well, as you know, Tony, DistroHopper's Digest Episode 6 was a rollicking good time. I hope our listeners enjoy it as much as we did. We don't have a dog and pony show. We have a Moss and Tony show. I installed Endeavor OS on my T430, a few issues easily solved, everything else installed. I had everything except Mumble and Audacity, and then I noticed it kept creating copies of boot records. My boot was a mass of multiple selections of the same distros. I used Grub Customizer to clean them up, and in next boot it created more. I reported the issue. It has now come off my T430. I still wanted to have something to review for October, and so decided to try a single install, what a concept, on the IdeaPad. I attempted to install OpenMandriva, but got nowhere. It failed to create a partition. I got my gpartadd disk out and redid the disk with a small swap partition and a large primary. I installed OpenMandriva LX4 just fine and rebooted. No boot. It didn't write the grub properly or whatever. I've had this issue before. So I tried Manjaro and it wouldn't even find my Wi-Fi. And so here I am with a machine that still has OpenMandriva installed on it. It just won't boot. So I grabbed a SuperGrub 2 CD and go into OM4. There's supposed to be a way to use SuperGrub 2 to write grub, but it isn't obvious. I've got more reading to do. But I am booting into OpenMandriva through SuperGrub 2.
I got an idea for you. Okay. Instead of putting it on a CD, SuperGrub 2, put it on a USB stick and call it a security feature.
Well, I understand that, except I have read a bunch of stuff of people trying to put SuperGrub 2 on a USB stick, and there were a lot of problems with that. Okay. I have some items for sale from my earlier inheritance. See my eBay listings, Moss23. Talk to me if you're interested in any of them. I did sell the Hackintosh. I did not really get fair value for it. But I have now $95 saved up towards the new laptop that we've talked about in the past and on the other show. eBay sales go towards that as well. I've also started a sponsor for DistroHoppers, but you're all welcome to join in. There's a link in the show notes. My day job has gone sideways. I still have it, and I'm finally working part-time, but my wonderful manager got demoted and moved for no reason, and the new manager just isn't the same. I had wanted 4 days per week instead of 5. I'm now getting 3. I'm looking for work again. Some employees have not stopped crying about the change, and I mean literally crying, and that was just 3 weeks ago. Another result of the change is I'm making even less income, and you've heard me whine about that way too much already. As this show is turning into Reader's Corner, I should note that I finished reading the Nightside series by Simon R. Green to my wife, and have started in On Temeror by Naomi Novik. Unlike Joe, I don't get audiobooks. I am the audiobook reader. What do you got to say to that, Joe?
You need to record that and put it on Audacity and make some money.
Well, I have signed up for a Libre Reader or whatever that site is called, but I haven't had time yet to do anything about that. I may have too much time soon, and I'll probably be whining about having too much time instead of doing something about it.
Yeah, it takes a while to get into that type of thing. And he's talking about actually being an audiobook reader for books that are out of copyright for LibriVox, which is a free source of online audiobooks.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, throw that Patreon out there, make a couple dollars. It might help.
Well, what I've been up to lately is not much. I need to solder something. And I don't really know what yet, but I have ordered a small set of LG HPS 820s. I haven't worked on those before, but I'm willing to give them a try since I have one that's partially working that I got in a lot a while ago. So hopefully between the new ones and the old one, I'll be able to get a few working. Now, my CPAP machine is dying. Makes getting sleep difficult, which makes motivation to do projects even more difficult. I did pull out one of my spare CPAP machines, and I've reprogrammed it to match my other one, and I think I got everything right. And for a while there, I was getting better sleep, but now I think my mask might be the issue. So I have to wait for my referral to go through again through the VA, and it's taking longer than it should, so that I can get the right one refurbished or replaced. As for my audiobook listening, I just recently finished up the Wheel of Time series again. I love that book series. I've listened to it several times, and I'm sure next year sometime I will listen to it again. It is very well done. Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson. And I still think they should have split the last book into two. It's extremely long. After I finished it, I think it was two days ago I finished it. I've been catching up on my podcasts again, and I think I'm right at 1 week behind again. My next audiobook listening will be the newest Alex Veris novel by Benedict Jacka, as well as the second book in the Last Reaper series, which I believe is Chaney. Alex Veris, it's getting a little long in the tooth, but it's still a very good series. It's slowed down a little bit, but it's still really enjoyable. The Last Reaper series, the books are extremely short. It's not necessarily great writing, but it is still a lot of fun. Mindless action, good adventure. I'm still waiting to pick up the newest book from M.D. Massey in the Junkyard Druid series, another series that is extremely fun, but not heavy on the content. And I think the only one I'm missing there is book 8. Ooh, and an interesting piece of news. I will be the acting manager at work for most of this month. I'm hoping to have some fun with that. My manager is taking 15 days out of town total. Well, 15 work days out of town total. So that leaves me in charge again, and we should be able to have some fun with it. I picked up some USB cables with switches in the middle. I needed one for the wireless phone charger in my car since my accessory port does not turn off when the vehicle turns off. Now, I know that there is a way to go in there and wire it to a different fuse point so that it will shut off with the car. Instead, I just got a USB cable with a switch in the middle, so I'm not constantly disconnecting and reconnecting and wearing out the cables. It works very well. I'm thinking about replacing the power supply with something a bit more powerful, then maybe work on some cable management. The current power supply I'm using, it's not the QC3 Fast Charge, which I know works a lot better with your more modern phones. And right now, if I set it on the wireless charger in the car, I'm looking at it taking an hour and 45 minutes to charge from about 30%. So I think I can get that a lot better. And that's really all I've been up to. Josh, what have you been up to?
Yeah, so my bit is quite short, but I've got quite a bit to cover. So yesterday and the day before, I was at the BBC, which is like the UK's national broadcaster, for Micbit Live, which is the board that I talk about probably too much on the show, even though it's nothing to do with the Micbit. But anyway, so the Micbit Foundation, who kind of like, I don't want to say own, but they like maintain the Micbit, ran their first conference in Manchester, and it was pretty good. We got some cool gifts, and there were some really good talks. And also the night before on the Friday, there was a party, where they had a band that played like Micbit themed songs that they'd wrote. And then the other cool thing was, this guy did a music performance for about an hour, with Micbit powered instruments. Now you probably think a kid's programming tool with a few buzzers, but no, it was pretty cool how he did it. Cause he had these like laser cut rabbits that had like solenoids on the back. And then when you have like this control board at the front, it's like, though, you know, those grids with like the rubber buttons that light up, that can be used for creating music. I'm not sure if anyone's used one of them before, but he had one of them that was Micbit powered, and then it would send out signals to all these like rabbits that were placed around the room with these solenoids on the back. I'm not sure if the microphone can pick it up, but it like did that, to create like musical effect around the room, and it was pretty cool actually, how he did it. So that was one cool thing about that. But there was also lots of talks, and panel discussions, and workshops as well. So I did a talk and a panel discussion on the kids' perspective of like the coding community, and I also did a stand for the magazine as well, which was pretty cool. It was the event wasn't big, but it wasn't like not enough people. It was the right amount of people for what it was, and hopefully they do it again next year. And it was quite a cool venue because Media City's where all of the UK's TV studios are. So all the big shows are filmed there, and you could see some of the sets, and the sports news was being filmed in the building we were in, which is pretty cool as well. So that's basically what I've been up to. No update on the phone situation. Still waiting for them to send a replacement on that, but hopefully that should be next week, because they say that they do it within 10 days, and tomorrow will be 7 days. So hopefully that gets sorted out soon. So I think that's it.
Did you get me any stickers? That's what I want to know.
I have some stickers somewhere that I can give you if you'd like.
Brilliant.
Wait
the
a minute.
Laptop's looking a bit bare.
Now the real question is, did you get me any stickers? How much does it cost to get Royal Mail over here?
Well, we've just sent out a load of magazines, and Royal Mail have lost some of them.
Oh, wow.
I wouldn't be using them again.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
So, how else do you send them, if not Royal Mail?
Probably by just a courier that do it. We're going to have to look at other options because they've lost them.
Wow.
Well, some people have got them, but like later than they should have done, and then some people just haven't got them. So I'm going to wait until tomorrow and then maybe phone them up. But we're covered up to £20 of compensation if they lost it, so It doesn't matter.
Yeah, but still, it's kind of the principle of the thing, right? I mean, you're trying to get something to a customer, and that's the deal.
Yeah, and the printers, like, wrecked half of the printing orders as well, but they got reprinted, so that's all fine. But, like, it's not great for our first go, because it, like, doesn't give us good credit, but we're being open and nice about it, so it's the best we could do.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the best you can do, and, yeah, I mean, it was cheaper than I think most magazines are going to be doing anyway. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, you have convinced me on this micro bit thing. I think you've just been wearing at me. Like, every time you bring it up, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, no micro bit. And then, fourth, fifth time, it's like, oh, okay, micro bit.
We were talking earlier about, I forget who it was now, was asking about controlling some RGB LED strips. And they were talking about saying, like, oh, yeah, just use Raspberry Pi. No, someone commented, use Arduino or Raspberry Pi. And I said, don't use Arduino or Raspberry Pi, use a Micro:bit instead. And I gave some reasons. One of them was for Raspberry Pi, Arduino, is that Arduino just, it's a pain to work with sometimes. Like, it just doesn't work all the time, and I don't like things that don't work. And then Raspberry Pi, one of them is that the Pi isn't actually a microcontroller. It's an actual Linux computer. So it doesn't have, like, the precise timings that are needed to control the LED strips. And the Python library for the Pi is quite complex compared to the Micro:bit. And also, the PWM signals for the audio of the Raspberry Pi interfere with PWM of the LEDs, so you need to do lots of config stuff. It just gets annoying. And the Micro:bit's seen as, like, this primary school, like, toy in a way, but it's actually much more than that. It's for everyone, really, but it's just not seen as a thing that you'd use as, like, a Raspberry Pi is. Because if you think, like, build a robot over Raspberry Pi, but if you're in the Micro:bit world, nobody really thinks of the Raspberry Pi anymore, because it's just so much easier to use a Micro:bit for most things. And it is the best tool for the job, in most cases. So, yeah, it is for everyone, and I can't really give numbers because I don't know if I'm allowed to. But, like, the Micro:bit is becoming really popular and is something that you'll be hearing a lot more about, not just from me, but it will become a more well-adopted tool.
That's really good. One of the things that I wanted to do with Micro:bit is get my daughter into doing some basic programming. So as it's cheap. Like, the whole kit, you get, like, a battery, a Micro:bit, and some of the cabling, USB cables, stuff like that, and all for, like, $17. And that is fantastic because it's got, like, a 5x5 grid of LEDs that you can get them to communicate and, like, send each other hearts and spell things out and scroll it across the little screen. And those are just some of the basic things that you can do with it. So, yeah, I'm really excited to kind of get started with it. And my daughter's a little young for all of this, but, I mean, she can definitely understand seeing her name roll across the screen or something like that. So hopefully with that, I can convince her to get into it a little bit more. I'm trying to cultivate a little nerd, and I hope this is going to help with that.
Yeah, and you can use EduBlocks as well, which is pretty cool.
That was exactly what I was planning on doing because, as you had said with EduBlocks, that you get both, right? You get, like, the Scratch type drag and drop interface, and then you can flip it around. And I don't want to say trick, but, you know, it's just there, so it's easy to understand what it is that you just did with pictures, and there it is right there in code, ready to be reused or studied if you need.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to use as well. Like, if you've got an iPad, there's, like, a kids coding app for it, so you could look at that as well.
iPad, what's that?
I've actually been using my iPad quite a bit, because I'm on an iPhone 5S, and the screen is just too small to actually do anything on it. So I've actually got my iPad out.
Yeah, really? Yep.
Should we get on with Mintcast?
No. All right. Well, if that's it, then we'll head to the news. All right. Well, first and foremost, we have to talk about the Linux Mint monthly update. So, Clem put out the September update. I think it was a couple days ago. It was recently. And it covers quite a bit. And one thing that might be controversial, but we'll get there. So one of the things that came out in the August monthly update was that they were working on this issue with the update manager where sometimes the icon was like way, way too big or got cropped or it was just invisible altogether. They fixed that. So good stuff. You know, those are the little paper cut things that you have to work through. Another one is they're working on the date format, respecting your locale better. I think, I mean, all across the world, everybody writes the date a little bit differently. And in 19.3, which will be the next minor update to 19, that will respect your locale better. The other thing, or another thing, was the X app status icon. They're continuing to work on that. This is the thing I was talking about with Clem kind of ended up doing like this whole how to program Linux Mint altogether. I don't think that was the intention of that video, but that's kind of how it ended up coming across to me. They've made some more progress on that, which means I'm guessing this is going to be Linux Mint 20 is going to be fully moved over to XApp status icon, if not before that. And system reports. So we had talked about, I think it was like GNOME logs or something like that. Where I was talking about how GNOME Logs was amazing because you could look through it. Well, it turns out Mint has one called System Reports. And I don't know how I didn't know about this, but it now supports versioning information. So right now, it'll tell you system information. So it's basically kind of like a really truncated LSHW. So just show you the hardware that's inside the system. It'll show you anytime it's crashed, anytime anything has gone wrong in Linux Mint, it'll give you some reports. And it will also give you just basic information about reports, right? Or just basic reporting about your system as well. But in some of the work that they've been doing, they're going to be dealing with versioning as well. So this will be kind of your one-stop shop for everything informational about Linux Mint. And in the versioning area, they're going to tell you about new upgrades. So you don't have to dig into the update manager in that menu to find out whether or not there's an update available. It'll be there in the system reports now. So check it every now and then and find out if things have gone wrong or if things have gone right. Really nifty bit of information that you can pull out from there. So the controversial bit, the logo is official, or almost official. But this is the one that stirred up all that controversy about they're dropping the leaf and they're dropping the colorization between the L and the M. It's just kind of becoming that one LM altogether, and they're just slapping it on a circle. And the biggest reason they did that was because when the icon got really, really small, it just didn't look great. And overall, it's just going to be easier to maintain a logo like this. I, for one, I like the new logo. But I mean,
just leave it alone, people.
Yeah, right. Show of hands. I mean, do y'all like the logo? Do you hate the logo? What's going on with that in your minds?
Yeah, it looks okay to me. Yeah.
It's a logo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the controversy about it was that, you know, changing the logo at all, or at least in a major way like that, kind of detracts from, I guess, that logo recognition. But I don't know. I like it.
I don't think, actually, when you look at it, you're gonna miss the old one after about 5 or 6 months. You'll have forgotten it because it's basically the same lettering, just a slightly different background, and it still tells you it's Linux Mint as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I didn't know that was a leaf until people got mad about it. I just thought it was like a two-tone diamond. I really did not know that it was a leaf. So it
just drag Leo out to the Linux Mint pub and get a beer or two.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think mostly it doesn't bother me because I didn't know it was a leaf. But still, yeah. Whoops, a little late on that one. And then lastly on this, we have Mintbox 3. So more progress has been made on the Mintbox 3. You can see some screenshots in the blog post, just kind of get an idea of how it looks. And it seems to me to be about the size of, and we were talking about this in Telegram too, the Lenovo Mini. So like the M92P Mini or the M700 series or 900 series Minis. Minis or tinies, I can't remember. But anyway, Google either, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And they're about that size. They're very, very small machines. So I'm looking forward to it.
I thought they were going for a larger machine this time.
I think they're going to have both, as far as I know. But the one that I'm looking at, the Mintbox 3, I think it is super tiny. So I don't know. Maybe it's just the pictures that make it look so small. But it's tiny. I don't know. I'll have to wait. I don't know if we have dimensions on it. I guess we can go look at the old one. But either way, they look really, really small. Anyway, next up, Mumble 1.3. And Tony, you've got some info on that.
Yeah, I haven't actually had a play with it yet, but there's a link to a Nitz Foss article in the show notes. And obviously, for a piece of software that's been around for quite a while, this is a big release. They're saying it's 10 years since it last had a major release. So there's a lot of things that have changed. So I'm not going to go through them all, but a couple of big ones are the fact that you've now got the ability to turn it into a dark theme, which for people operating on laptops might be good for power management. Because apparently dark themes help with reducing the amount of power draw on laptops. And the UI has been totally redesigned. But Leo, you're actually running it at the moment, aren't you? So what do you actually think about it?
Yeah, I'm living on the edge here. I didn't really test it much except for in our meeting yesterday. And it seemed to work just fine. So far, I haven't dropped out. And I like it. I'm running it through Snap. So this is, it's new to me. I don't run a whole lot of Snaps, but I installed SnapD just to try it out. And it's great. I don't have any problems with it. Everything is where I expected it to be. I don't think there's much as far as changes go. The icons are different. But I'm not sure if that's because it's a Snap or just, I don't know. Maybe that's just how it is.
Good. Anyway, so I'll be checking that out in the next week or two to have a look at it, see if I can get the... I'll probably do what you've done. I'll install the Snap and have a play with it, maybe report back at a future date on a future podcast.
Yeah, I didn't bother to see if it was available in Flatpak, but I suspect that it probably is. So in Mint, you could just go to the software updater or the software manager and just install it from there. I don't know. I tend to live in the command line, so yeah, I just did it that way. So next up is CentOS 8 released. Woohoo! So on the other side of the Debian divide, CentOS. So RHEL was released a few months ago. CentOS 8, everybody was waiting with bated breath for CentOS 8 to drop. And it looks like one of the things that people were waiting for to actually jump on the train was EPEL. So that is where... I guess that would be kind of considered like our universe and multiverse in Ubuntu, where you have extra packages that aren't maintained by the Ubuntu people themselves. That's kind of what EPEL is. And so it looks to me, there have been a couple articles related to how to add it. And so it seems like it's available, which means that that's the kick that a lot of people needed to get onto the CentOS 8 train. So if you were considering it, try it out. But on top of that, CentOS Stream. Now, this is something that I don't know if I need it. I don't know if I want it, but I feel like it's a really good middle ground between CentOS and Fedora. So Stream is going to live in the middle between those two distros and will basically be a rolling release distro of CentOS. So you'll get the new kernel upgrades and you'll get all of the things that you would need, that you would normally get going from like 8.1 to 8.2 to 8.3. You just get all of that. There's no special thing that you need to do. If you install CentOS Stream, it's just going to keep up. And this is good for people that are developing drivers or software or things like that, and they just need to know if it's going to be working on the newer versions of CentOS 8. So it's great for them, and it's also great for, I would say, home servers. If you just absolutely have to run CentOS, but you're running newer-ish hardware, if you're running like super new hardware, I don't think you're running CentOS, or at least not without some kind of custom or new out-of-band kernel. So this might help with a lot of that if you're running stuff at the house. So yeah, CentOS 8, I might give it a go. I don't know. We'll see how this works. I've been playing with Fedora a lot, and that seems to be my sweet spot. So I don't know if I want to go backwards. Next up, Ubuntu 19.10 beta is available now. And this is the one that I can't pronounce, so I'm not going to try to. It's, what is the... for some reason, I want to keep saying Intrepid Ibex, and it's not it. That is an old one. But anyway, the thing that I've been waiting for...
It's the Eon one.
You know. Eon? Okay, all right. I'm going to defer to you on that one. But my favorite feature of this is kernel 5.3. I have been waiting and waiting and waiting for 5.3 because 5.3 contains a lot of the bits and bobs that you need to run the Radeon 5700 and 5700 XT. I've been holding off on getting a new video card until I knew that Linux Mint would be able to support all that. And it seems to me about a month after release, you are able to select the new, hardware enablement kernel through the Linux Mint kernels thing in the software updater app. So about then, I'll be able to report back and let you know if I've decided to buy that video card or not. So, yeah, they're not cheap, so I'm waiting. I need it to work.
Yeah, obviously, Ubuntu 19.10 beta is available, but also... I believe there's a beta available for the Mate desktop environment version, because that's an official flavor now. And Martin Wimpress reports they've been doing a lot of work on paper cuts in the Mate version. So if people are running that and want to go and check out the 19.10 beta, go and have a look and see some of the improvements they've made over there as well.
Yeah, as far as I know, all of the flavors have gotten their beta release. So yeah, if you're a fan of Budgie or GNOME or KDE or Plasma, I guess, or any of the other flavors, XFCE, LXQT now, isn't it? Go give that a spin. See if you like it. See if 5.3 fixes anything for you. And as paper cuts, each of those distros fix stuff.
Seems like every release, one of the flavors has a big step forward, and they want to break it up so that only one of them is getting that attention. There was when Ubuntu Studio had an 18.10, and in 1903 it was Ubuntu Budgie, and now it's Ubuntu Mate.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm happy to see that all of these things are moving forward. And this isn't in the show notes, but I remember seeing it around. Turns out... there is now an Ubuntu Cinnamon flavor. I've been following them on Twitter for a little while, and it seems like they're an actual thing now. So interesting. I wonder if they're going to be official enough for the 2004
release. They're
being
considered for official flavor.
Oh, very cool. So, Linux Mint will have direct competition with a pure Ubuntu flavor now. Ooh.
It already does. Ubuntu Mate.
True. Oh, that's right. Yeah. No, you're right. I guess the Mate and XFCE both do have, exactly.
All three flavors of Linux Mint will have competition in their Ubuntu brethren.
That's good, because I think it's just there to showcase the cool stuff that Linux Mint does. They don't make huge underlying changes, but they fix those little paper cut issues that, as Tony was saying, that Martin Wimpress was fixing. They fix a lot of that before I think it ever really gets to the point where people are hating on one thing or another or getting away from it. So, yeah, I do appreciate Mint for a lot of that. Then next up, we have Firefox updates to 69.0.2. And this is a small maintenance upgrade, but the big news here is that YouTube videos would crash in Linux. And, yeah, if you're using Firefox and YouTube's crashing, not very good. So... If you haven't, sudo apt-get upgrade or, you know, click on that little shield up there and get updates. Get that new Firefox going. So yeah, so those don't crash anymore. There were some other issues as well, like some Windows 10 parental controls things, but obviously that's only Windows 10. And Office 365 was having some issues in Firefox across all the different platforms as well. But yeah, overall, some fixes and a couple of enhancements as well. So the tracking protection got some updates as well. So either way, good stuff. Get on that new Firefox train if you haven't yet. Then next we had Linux kernel 5.4. 5.3 just got released, and then, well, at least in Ubuntu, and then 5.4 is already being worked on since about late September, early October. And one of the cool things about that is, yep, XFAT is here. It's gonna be in the stable 5.4 branch. So, great! I don't have to install those two utilities anymore. Hooray!
Well, it's going to be the messy Samsung coded, from what I understand.
Oh, no. How's Linus going to feel about that?
Well, they're just going to fix it. 5.5.
They're going to kind of roll it slowly in. And, okay. Well, that's really cool. And one of the other cool things that's going to happen is better support for AMD video cards. And I would suspect, I don't have a list here, but I would suspect that includes the 5700 series. And as well, fixes for some gaming issues in Wine and Proton. Oh, how funny. They spelled photon, not proton. That's funny. Anyway, so some really cool stuff coming down in 5.4. So hopefully for Linux Mint 20, that means that we'll have 5.4 or better just right out of the box. So great. That's good stuff.
Well, Linux Mint goes for a LTS kernel. I don't know if 5.4 is that kernel.
They go with whatever Ubuntu 18.04 had, or 16.04, well, but back then there was some changes, but 18.04. So they're sticking on 15? I think it's 4.15. So unless you make changes, it'll be 4.15 through the life of Linux Mint 19. And if they stay on that same track, that means that whatever 20.04 ships with, I would guess that's 5.4 or later on the kernel, that's what they'll ship with and stick with. So I'm hoping that means that Linux Mint 20 is going to just play really nice with the 5700 Radeon video card right out of the box. And if that's the case, I'm sold. I'm 100% sold on that, and I'll go with that video card.
Well, I'm not the most up-to-date. I have not seen any 5 points getting LTS. The last LTS I've seen was 4.19.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't really kept up with what Linus decides is the LTS, or the team decides what the LTS is. I usually just stick on whatever Ubuntu gives me as their LTS, because they do all the backporting and all of the, if you do the hardware enablement kernel stuff, you get that new stream of stuff. But overall, the security stuff is really what I'm worried about. I'll leave it on whatever the LTS ships with on a server, unless I need the hardware support, which I don't have equipment that's that new, so it doesn't affect me much. Then we get Pi 4, better Raspbian support. So luckily for you, that means that we're not doing a whole Raspberry Pi show. But some of the really cool things is that they're updating the EEPROM. Some of the audio settings tool has been modified to work better with the volume plugin. And just some basic updates. So if you have a Raspberry Pi running Raspbian, go get yourself an update, because there's a good chance that there's some, like Bluetooth, is going to work better for you.
Yeah, and it's a good thing that they're updating, you know, the Raspbian support, because there are currently no other officially supported operating systems that work on the Pi 4.
I know Ubuntu Mate was supposed to be getting close or getting there.
Yeah, they're doing development work on it at the moment, but they haven't actually done a release yet.
Interesting. Okay. And then, as Moss said, the 4.19 kernel is LTS. That's what Raspbian runs on. Very cool. Then, next up, Moss is going to tell you about Pine 64.
Well, there's an October update on Pine 64. Everyone has been giving a lot of doo-doo to the people over at Purism for the way that they don't have transparency in their updates, and they just make decisions when they miss their next deadline. Well, Pine 64 just showed us how to do it. they actually went down and said, well, we had these problems, these delays. We're sorry. This is how we're dealing with it. Some of it has to do with the problems in Hong Kong. And it's really a good article. The link is in the show notes. I think everyone should read it just to see how a good PR department works when they really have Linux at heart.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Josh alluded to it earlier, too. Like, I don't think anybody really is just going to rip on someone for giving it their all. And as long as you're transparent about it, I think that that goes a long way in, you know, just making sure that you got that goodwill going both ways. Just be honest, and I think you'll get a really good response. So that's a good thing.
I did notice that there was no update on the Pine Tab. They talked about the 64 Pro, the PineBook Pro. They talked about the Pine Phone, and they talked about the Pine Watch. But I didn't see anything about the Pine Tab.
Yeah, I really hope that Pine Watch is going to become a thing and is, like, really, really hackable, because that is...
Oh, and they announced a new price on the Pine Tab at $20.
What? $20? How do you do that? How do you even do
that? The Pine Watch? Because it was at $25.
Yep. In this newsletter, go look at your show notes, it did get announced at $20.
And
that's a good price.
And that's the watch or the tab?
The watch.
Oh, wow. That's $5 cheaper.
Yeah, my only issue with it is that from what I've read on it, it's only supposed to work with Linux phones. So I couldn't, like, pair it with my Linux tablet or my Linux computer.
I don't know. Take it up with Pine 64.
Yeah, that's going to be the thing, I think. Like, as stuff comes out, it looks like this thing is going to be hackable. So I don't see any reason why you wouldn't be able to... I mean, as a developer, I guess, put some stuff together to get it to work with Linux. So you just hang on, and I bet someone will take care of it for us. And
they
then
have
I get the
pictures.
Throw.
They have pictures of the Pine Phone open and a prototype with just showing the blocks, not showing anything in the blocks, and also the dock for it. So go look at the pictures.
Yeah,
internals exposed.
I'm looking at them right now, and it looks interesting. So hopefully it's hackable, and that means I get to throw money at whoever writes the API to make all that work.
It says, as for pricing, we are presently aiming for a price point of approximately $20. The price includes the watch and a charging dock. We decided on selling the 20mm watch strap separately, since most people have their own preferences of style, and hope to carry a wide selection at launch. These straps will vary in price, starting at approximately $3 for regular silicone sports straps. You can obviously pick up any standard 20mm watch straps on your own. They will most likely fit the Pine Time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I can't wait.
Yeah, $20, I'll definitely pick one up.
And next up, we got two stories of rough seas. First up, the GNOME Foundation is being sued because of Shotwell Photo Manager. Yeah, when you read into the story...
Patent troll, boys and girls, patent troll.
That's exactly what I was going to say. When you read into it, it turns out it's just some very generic moving photos over a network or something like that. And it's like, well, okay, well, that's every app that does photos. So, yeah.
Yeah, the problem with these kind of things is that legal bills can be so expensive that a lot of companies and small organizations settle out of court just to get because it would cost them more to go to court. I don't know what the GNOME Foundation's planning, but, you know, maybe we can bung them a few dollars or a few quid, depending where you are in the world, to help them pay the legal fees for this one, because it's definitely pointless.
Yeah, exactly. On a not better note, Docker is in deep trouble too. So, Joe, you know a little bit about this?
Yeah, I've read the article. Docker is in deep trouble financially because they're simply not making any money. Their Docker Swarm was supposed to be their big moneymaker, but then Kubernetes came along and said, nope, not going to happen. So they have no business model at this point, and it's really kind of a problem for them. They need a way to make money, and they don't have it yet. So Who knows what's going to happen to Docker in the next few years? There are other options that are up and coming, but there's nothing quite as robust as Docker is at this time.
Yeah, I think Docker is going to be fine because they were the first to market with the containers as we know them today. I mean, we've had Chroot and all kinds of weird jails and all that kind of thing for a while. But yeah, Docker was the first to market with something like this. So they have that advantage. And I think that means that so many people adopted them that I don't know that Docker is going to fail. I really don't think that's going to happen, at least not quickly anyway. So
Well, even if it does fail, the code is still out there. So it might change, but it'll still be there.
Call it Docker Open. Open Docker. Ooh, there you go. You're welcome, whoever takes over that code base. All right, and that's it for our news. So let's chat a little bit about XIM in our security update. All right, so we are not a server podcast, though we do kind of get into the weeds a lot. This one is very specific, but there is a user-based slant to it. So hang tight. Give me 10 minutes and hang tight. So XIM, this is an open source mail server, Unix-based, that has about 60% of the market share. So they are massive. If there is one mail server that you're probably going to encounter in the wild, it's probably going to be XIM. And this is also going to be a story about how not to, or why not to run your own mail server, just in general. Whether you're, I don't know, if you're big enough and you have the staff for it, then and the knowledge base for it, then yeah, sure, go ahead, run XIM. But there's still some landmines that you're going to run over. And that's, yeah, let's talk about that. So XIM had a bad September. Early on in September, they got originally this Lilac story, which is a ransomware that gets into your server and locks all of your user files, puts a .. Lilac extension at the back of every single one of them, and then in every directory that it does that in, it creates a README file with a note about how to pay the ransom so you can unlock your stuff. So, boys and girls, this is the whole reason why you want to keep good backups. And Tony reminded me the other day, but I say it all the time: backups equals backups minus one. So unless you have two backups, you don't have any backups. And unless you test your backups, that second backup isn't worth anything. So yeah, again, just back up your stuff. Then later on in that same week, it turned out that millions of XIM servers were vulnerable to an exploit that gave root access. So versions of XIM between 4.80 to 4.92.1 were susceptible to a remote execution flaw. And what that basically means is someone anywhere in the world that has remote access to your server, right? They can ping it, they can see it. That means that they can send your server a specially crafted TLS handshake. So TLS is the language they speak to get encrypted, right? Send a specially crafted handshake and confuses the XIM server, and it drops you down to what is essentially a root shell where you can run code. And that's not good, because you shouldn't be able to run any code on an email server as a remote user. So that happened about early to mid-month in September. And then toward the end of the month, it was about September 30th, another exploit came out that was 4.92.2. So after you got all that remote exploit stuff taken care of with in the previous article, you get hit by this new one, which allows remote attackers to denial of service your server, which basically is just a fancy way to say take it down, right? It's not servicing, it's not doing email anymore, as well as can pivot into a remote code execution. So you're kind of in the same boat that you were in early in September. So long story short, patch up to version 4.92.3. That is currently okay, that as far as we know. And this means that anybody that's running Ubuntu, Arch, Debian, and Fedora, as of September 30th, run your updates and you'll be okay. Those things have been either backported or that version directly is available to you. So here's where the user part comes in. it might not be a bad idea to ask who your mail provider is using to provide mail. Now, some companies, some people, if it's individuals that you know, might be willing to share this information with you, but some are not. So send an email to figure this out. And if they're on any of the vulnerable versions, it might be a good idea to consider not using that email provider, at least for the time being, because remote code execution means that they can take your emails, presumably. So long story short, find out what your provider is on, and it might not be a bad idea to back up the data that you have on those servers, just in case they get hit with something else. Because if you can run remote code on a server, that means that anybody can just walk by, drop some ransomware, and encrypt up all your emails so you won't be able to get access to them anymore. So might not be a bad idea to do some backups on your email. So yeah, if nothing else, back up your emails. That way, you have a copy of them in case something bad happens. But anyway, that's enough gloom and doom for today. So, yeah, that's it for our security review. And then before we go, tell us where we can find you, Joe.
Well, you can find me on a couple other podcasts. I'm on the Linux Link Tech Show, which is at www.tllts.org. I'm also on the Linux Lugcast, which is at www.linuxlugcast.com. You can find me on MeWe, or you can email me, jb@mintcast.org.
And you can find Bo, even though he's not here on the show today, at theundercastnetwork.com. And Moss, where can we get more of you?
Well, you can find me at Triad Bardic College or Peaceful Hippo on MeWe. My music's on Bandcamp. I posted links to my YouTube channel or my friend Robert Warren's YouTube channel. Moss at mintcast.org, distrohoppersdigest@gmail.com, or sponsor us.
And Tony Hughes, more of you.
Yeah, I'm on Hacker Public Radio. I'm host ID 338. I do an occasional blog at tony-hughes.blogspot.com. I'm on Twitter, TonyH1212. You can also email me at distrohoppersdigest@gmail.com or th@mintcast.org.
And Tony Watts isn't here this go-around either, but you can find him at tw@mintcast.org, or you can find him, Echoes of Savages, if you just throw that into YouTube. And Josh, what about you?
You can find me, Josh, at edgeblocks.org, edgeblocks.org, and all about current Twitter.
Very nice. And I'm leochavez.org and at leochavez on Twitter. And you can get your 5-minute news digest at Full Circle Weekly News. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Just a little behind. But before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. Josh for all his work on the web and the live stream every couple of weeks. ByteMark Hosting for hosting Mintcast.org and our Mumble server. Archive.org for hosting our audio files. And the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem and Co.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music. And thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.
That will do.